foreign ministers from the U.S., the U.K., Russia, China, France, plus Germany, of course the P5 plus one nations, and Iran. They emerged from closed-door talks on Thursday to announce they have reached an historic framework agreement regarding Iran's nuclear program and the lifting of international sanctions. In Washington, President Obama applauded the preliminary deal, saying it satisfies the core objectives of the negotiating team by cutting off Iran's possibilities of developing a nuclear weapon.
First, Iran will not be able to pursue a bomb using plutonium because it will not develop weapons-grade plutonium. Second, this deal shuts down Iran's path to a bomb using enriched uranium. Iran has agreed that its installed centrifuges will be reduced by two-thirds. Third, this deal provides the best possible defense against Iran's ability to pursue a nuclear weapon covertly, that is, in secret. Between now and the end of June, the negotiators will continue to work through the details of how this framework will be fully implemented, and those details matter.
And, of course, that was President Obama yesterday speaking at the White House, and international reaction has been swift and, for the most part, positive, but obviously still many obstacles in the way. And to try to make some sense of these developments, historic developments perhaps, is Dr. Paul Rogers, a regular voice here on the Friday edition of The Morning Show. He's a professor in the Department of Peace Studies at Bradford University in the UK. He's Open Democracy's international security editor, where he writes a weekly column on global security. He also is the author of a number of books, and he's working on a book right now, so we interrupted his work flow so he can join us this morning for a brief moment. Thank you, Dr. Paul Rogers, for joining us in this last minute.
Good morning, Mario. I'm very pleased to talk to you again.
So again, some people are calling it historic. Obviously, a lot of obstacles remain. How significant is what we heard yesterday?
I think if it moves from a framework agreement to a full agreement, it's actually hugely significant. One of the few signs of an improving atmosphere in at least one part of what's an extremely troubled region. I think the confluence of interest has come together sufficiently. From a European view, Obama clearly wants a major foreign policy achievement during the latter part of his second term. And by and large, Europeans have been far less anti-Iran than have successive United States administrations. We had an embassy in Iran, which I visited a few years ago, to maintain diplomatic relations, apart from occasional spats. But on the Iranian side, I think ever since President Rouhani came in a couple of years ago, the atmosphere within Iran has changed a lot. And one has to remember that while he may be not seen as in any sense a liberal in the Western sense, within Iranian political politics, he's actually sort of much more moderate than others. And it's worth remembering that he won the election on the first ballot against four hard-line candidates. So he has quite a lot of authority, even though the supreme leader has the ultimate word. And I think the Iranians have found the sanctions process very difficult. It has caused problems for them. And in addition, of course, the decrease in oil prices is problematic as well. So in a sense, both sides have quite a fundamental desire to get an agreement on this. It's still a surprise the extent to which you have some detail coming out, even in what was announced yesterday. Many of the really experienced journalists in and around the hotel at Lausanne were saying that there were huge problems and they wouldn't get a proper framework agreement. They have. That, I think, is the really positive news of the last week or so.
Looking at some of the specifics, and I was reading some of the specific details of the at least framework, it does seem kind of unique in verification and in the kind of dismantlement of the program that currently exists in Iran. Could you give us a thumbnail sketch of some of those aspects, if you can?
That's certainly the case. I mean, essentially, under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Iran has signed, the International Atomic Energy Authority does have the right of challenge inspections and many other things. For example, you know, one of the biggest uranium enrichment plants in the world is one recently constructed in Brazil. That's to produce enriched uranium for power stations for export abroad. And the IAEA can indeed inspect that. But the level of inspections in Iran is far more severe. It's far more precise and detailed. And it's something which the Iranians seem to have accepted. It wasn't clear that they would. The IAEA was already involved in quite serious inspections, more than virtually any other country is required to allow. But the Iranians, it's gone even further. And I think this is actually a surprise to quite a number of Western analysts, because it means that Iran has decided as of now that it is not actually interested in developing nuclear weapons, either now or really for the next 10 or 15 years. It wants to retain the technical capability to do so, to break out from the treaty, but only, it appears, if the security situation, changed radically across the Middle East. But it is the level of actual inspections, the degree of verification, which is surprising. I can think of very few that match it. Possibly the original Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty back in, 1987. That was bilateral, American and Soviet, but that actually had a level of inspection which was unparalleled in the nuclear side, and essentially I think the Iranian acceptance of these requirements is at a similar level, possibly if not more.
Yeah, still, it might not be enough. Obviously, there are many obstacles, perhaps most visible being Israel. You talked about the regional security situation, which I want to get to in a second, but Israel, obviously, Netanyahu put out his statement saying how this just makes the world more dangerous and that it's not addressing the total dismantlement of the nuclear program in Iran, which is the core objective of Israel. Can Israel's opposition be enough to perhaps derail this, considering its influence in the political dynamic in Washington?
I don't know. You're probably much better equipped to answer that from within the American scene. As an outsider, I do get the impression that at least under this presidency, under the Obama administration, the Israeli government, particularly under Netanyahu, counts for less than most Israeli governments. It does appear from a European perspective that he damaged his position in the eyes of people, you know, rather across the American political spectrum, but by no means completely, by the way he came and addressed Congress. My understanding is that, in a sense, while Obama may not be popular, the idea of sort of bypassing the presidency is something rather different. But I say that's an outside view, but I think more broadly, Israel does not have the clout that it had. It certainly does not in Europe, one has to say that.
Is there a danger about a military action, unilateral from Israel? I mean, they've done it before.
They've done it before, but to actually take on the Iranian facilities is a much, much bigger job. And in fact, Israel does not have the necessary deep-penetrating conventional warheads to take out the most difficult-to-reach of the Iranian facilities. In fact, the United States, with its new massive ordnance penetrator, is the only country equipped to do so. And so the Israelis are limited in that. They could set back the Iranian program. But if they were to do that, what you can guarantee would be Iran would withdraw immediately from the Non-Proliferation Treaty and actually seek to get nuclear weapons. So I think Israel will face a lot of restraint from the United States and a lot of anger from a number of other countries. So while it might want to do this, I think there are quite profound difficulties in it actually taking it on.
Much different than the circumstances when it bombed the Iraqi nuclear facility, many years ago, two decades ago, and some other actions it took against Syria.
The Iraqi one's an interesting case. They took out the Osirak reactor because it was capable of producing plutonium as a byproduct, and they assumed that was because Iraq was going to develop nuclear weapons through that route. The more recent evidence suggests that, in fact, the reactor was not capable of doing that. And paradoxically, what happened after that raid was when the Iraqis really set in scene, in trend, the development of nuclear weapons using the much more dispersed uranium enrichment route. So it's actually counterproductive even then, although the Israelis will not accept this. But certainly with Iraq, if there's any kind of attack on Iran, I should say, then that would certainly be counterproductive. Of course, once you start bombing a country like Iran, and it then starts to redevelop its capabilities, you have to keep on bombing. Okay. It's actually starting. It's a very different situation and very dangerous.
We're speaking with Dr. Paul Rogers, Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University in the UK, Open Democracy's International Security Editor. I wanted to ask about the regional situation, because it's not only Israel that's concerned and that's raising objections to the agreement. Obama, in his talk, we didn't play this clip, but he said, quote, "Our concerns will remain with respect to Iranian behavior so long as Iran continues its sponsorship of terrorism, its support for proxies who destabilize the Middle East, its threats against America's friends and allies like Israel," unquote. I mean, for one, it sounds a lot like the same kind of policies the U.S. is carrying out, dealing with proxies in its own, in support of its own security interests. But this is Israel's position, that as long as the broader so-called behavior of Iran isn't checked. And this is the same feeling that the Saudis posit. This disagreement is just going to make things more dangerous. Given what's happening now in Yemen, what's of course been unfolding for months and almost years now in Iraq and elsewhere in the region, how does that regional instability affect the future of this agreement?
All one can say is that it's making it very much more complex. Now, on Yemen, the level of Saudi intervention is very considerable. There's something like 8 countries across the Middle East that are now contributing aircraft to this quite large air war, which is now underway. So this is not a small endeavor, it's a major one. And it may well be that Saudi Arabia is going to get heavily involved in the Yemen war, and it will be very difficult for the Saudis to actually succeed in ousting the Houthis without some sort of major ground intervention. The extraordinary thing about Iran, though, which of course does tend to support the Houthis, but not hugely, is that in Iraq, Iran is actually seen as a sort of almost a shadow ally of the United States, because Iran also is very much opposed to Islamic State, as indeed is the United States. So this paradox that Iran is getting more influence in Iraq because, of course, of the Shia majority, which is of concern particularly to the Saudis, yet for the United States, the wider, more difficult fight against Islamic State cannot be proceeded with effectively unless the Iranians are also involved. So you have a position of quite extraordinary complexity now, but it is not simply a question of Iran bad on everything from an outside perception. There are areas in which Iranian and American influence and policies actually coalesce, and that's an extraordinary indication of the current situation we are in.
Right, it seems, and this will be kind of to wrap up, it seems that Obama hasn't gone far enough. I mean, it seems like he should have probably moved forward in a much broader diplomatic outreach to Iran to perhaps, deal with all these other issues. Obviously, it's a much, very complex, the dynamics are different in each country, but it seems that Obama could have really should have taken a stand, perhaps, diplomatically, not just to deal with the nuclear issue, but to perhaps find ways to develop a better relationship with Iran after so many years of really making no progress at all, but actually making things worse.
I would agree with you, but there may well be a reasoning that, in fact, let's get this very big issue, if not sorted, then easing a lot. And what, in a sense, if the nuclear issue is solved come June, then that opens a door for the United States and Iran to have better relations overall. So that may be something for the future. But both of them, curiously, face the same quandary, that they're both bitterly opposed to Islamic State. But Islamic State actually wants the fight. It wants to present itself as the true bulwark or guardian of Islam against outsiders and against the Shia of Iran. And this is where you have this extraordinary difficulty. There's the worry about Islamic State, but it actually wants people to go to war with it. Mm. And there's no easy solution to that, except that if American-Iranian relations do improve during the next few months, then there might at least be closer coordination. But that also involves trying to keep in with the Saudis as well. So I think you're going to have a very high demand for some of the highest levels of diplomacy at the professional level of the State Department than we needed for at least a decade.
Not to mention the Likud sector of the Republican Party that would do everything it can to make sure anything of that nature would be derailed. Anyway, Dr. Yeah. Paul Rogers, I appreciate your time. I know you're working on a book right now, and we've interrupted your process, but it's much appreciated as always.
Thank you very much indeed. Okay.